We're going to start off. I want you to do something with me here. First thing I want you to do is grab one of these sermon pads. If you don't have it, then you just grab your bulletin, find an empty space on your bulletin. So get that in your hand. Get a pencil, one of the pencils. Then what I want you to do is to turn to somebody near you. Now, if you can find somebody behind you or in front of you that you don't know as well, that's going to be even better. But just kind of find one other person. Just find one other person, okay? You got it? Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to give you 60 seconds, and you're going to draw that other person. All right? Go. You have 25 seconds left. No, come on, keep it going. I can tell there's some masterpieces being made right now. I can tell. All right, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Show each other your pictures. Show each other. Here we go. Show each other. There we go. All right. Let me ask you right now. I could feel the tension rise in the room as soon as I said you have to draw somebody else. And then in 60 seconds. I did this exercise once, and I had no idea. I just met the person sitting next to me, and I was so like embarrassed of my little drawing, and I didn't want her to see it because I thought it'd be embarrassing because I'm not a great artist. And I thought to myself, when did this happen to me? You know, when I was 4, if you asked me to draw somebody, I would with confidence draw you and show you. But then we have this like little exercise, and we get kind of nervous about it, and it's a ridiculous exercise. 60 seconds to draw somebody with a church notepad and a golf pencil? Come on, this is not going to be an awesome picture. But somehow it's hard for us to do. It reminds me of a joke, though, the confidence of a kid. There's a joke, there's a kindergarten little girl, and she's in her class, and the teacher says, "What are you drawing?" And she says, "I'm drawing God." And the teacher says, "Well, we don't know what God looks like." And the girl looks at the teacher and says, "I'll be done in a minute, then you'll see." Right? There's a certain confidence we have as kids because we know there's people looking out for us. I wanted you to do that exercise because we start off with something so wildly different today. And the thing is, what we don't have in our reading that was from before is that there's three times, it happens in Matthew and in Mark, there's these three times where after they declare that they know Jesus is the Messiah, he begins to explain what that means. And it's something along the lines of this: "We're going to Jerusalem. I'm going to be delivered into the hands of sinful men. They're going to kill me. And on the third day, I'm going to rise again." And the response from the disciples is always so wild. Last week, we talked about it. Peter takes Jesus aside and says, "Stop talking that way. What are you doing?" This week, the disciples, this message completely goes over their head, and then they come to Jesus with this question. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And what they're asking really is, who among us is the greatest? Really interesting question. Jesus, we all think we're kind of the greatest, so we need you to be the tiebreaker and tell us who the greatest actually is. But isn't that an interesting question? Who is the greatest? If you listen to sports radio, right, that happens all the time. In their prime, who's the greatest? Would Jordan have beat LeBron, or would LeBron have beaten Jordan? You know, there's really strong feelings about that debate, especially in Chicago. But we wonder this. We wonder who's the best, who's the greatest. Even like in our own little office situation, you go in and say, look around, who's the best salesperson? Who's the best teacher? Who's the best at whatever it is? in our neighborhoods, we try to give the impression that we're the best parents, you know? We post stuff on Facebook. They don't realize that was the 75th time trying to take that picture. But we post it saying, well, this, aren't we great? Oh, and the other side of it is maybe we have the notion that I would love to be great, but I'm never going to be great. And maybe it's the opposite. Maybe we fall in kind of this depression when we think about this question, who is the greatest? Because maybe there's a lot of things I struggle with. Wherever you're at, wherever the disciples were at, they're asking this question about who the greatest was. And Jesus, as he often does, has this surprising response. And he called to him a child, and he put him in the midst of them. Now, one of the ways you could translate put him in the midst of them is actually the verb to cause to stand. He causes someone to stand. I was talking to Pastor Chris Whitby, who's preached here a number of times this last week about this, and he said, you know, that's actually, probably the thought is it's a little kid that's maybe holding on to Jesus' fingers. He causes him to stand. So he has this object lesson in the middle of these disciples, and then he says something really wild about children. Now, we have a culture where we are kind of we focus so much on kids in our culture, and it's a good thing. I love that we focus so much on children. In the ancient world, parents loved their children, grandparents loved their children. Everybody loved kids. They liked kids, but kids weren't the focus. In fact, kids were kind of another mouth to feed until they could give back to the family or give back to society. And if you were an orphan in the ancient world, you were in really bad shape because you would be overlooked so easily. Kids were often overlooked. Widows and orphans were very, very vulnerable people. Still are, but especially in the ancient world. So for Jesus to pull this kid out and have him stand in front of everybody, everybody's kind of wondering what he's going to say, and they don't expect him to say what he says, which is this. He said, "You truly, I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child will be greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me." Now, there's three interesting anchor points in this one little phrase here. The first is this. Jesus is acknowledging something. Unless you turn, unless you change to become like children. Now, I think what Jesus is describing is something that we all experience in our lives. When we're very young, we have no problem recognizing that we are dependent upon God. But what do our parents do? And they're doing a good job of this because it's important that we learn these things. We then learn how to be less dependent upon other people. And then eventually, as grown-ups, we become those who provide for other people. And that's a great thing. That's how it's supposed to be. But as we grow in our skills and our abilities, as we're less dependent on people to do things for us, and we're more those who give to others and provide for others, the thing that Jesus is saying, what we need to turn from, is the idea that we ever lose our dependence upon God. So yes, we need to become those who are more independent and those who do more and those who provide more and those who look after people. Yet at the same time, we need to turn from those things and remember that even as an adult, as an accomplished adult, whoever you might be, I am utterly dependent upon God. As much as a kid that's holding onto the fingers of their parent to stand up, I need God to be holding me in his grace. So we need to turn. We need to be reminded of that. And again, there's an activity with that. If you don't become like children, you never enter the kingdom of heaven. Well, if you try to get to heaven on your own, you're not going to get there. We are utterly dependent upon grace, Christ, who died and rose for us to be with him in heaven. So resulting from that is then we humble ourselves like children. And like children who understand that they're dependent, we just understand we're dependent upon God. That's greatness in the kingdom of heaven, is coming humbly before God and saying, I need you. I can't do this without you. Please save me. And then again, when we're in that position, we're also then less likely to overlook people. We're more likely to receive people, which is exactly what Jesus talks about. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. We turn, we humble ourselves, and then God opens our hearts It's a beautiful thing, but he takes this very seriously. In fact, this is not necessarily a new thing, this idea. God in the Old Testament, he tells the prophet Hosea, especially addressing the tribe of Ephraim. Ephraim was a tribe that knew that they depended upon God. Then they got to a point where they kind of lost sight of that. They said, we don't really need God as much. And God's heart was breaking, and he had them, through the prophet Hosea, tell them, yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. The picture is God saying, I was the one who held your fingers, taught you how to walk. I took them up by their arms, and they did not know that I was I who healed them. I led them with cords of kindness, with the bands of love. I became to them as one who eases the yoke on their jaws. I bent down and I fed them. God said, I loved them like children, yet they've forgotten that they depend upon me. Jesus takes this seriously too. That whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a great millstone fastened around his neck and be drowned in the depths of the sea. That's harsh language. I don't have to tell you that. But what is Jesus saying? We are not to be flippantly overlooking other people. We should be caring about children and not just children, but anybody who's vulnerable. We need to be looking after them rather than leading people to sin, leading people to be neglected. And again, harsh language, but he's making a very important point. He cares about everybody. And yet there's times when we overlook people. And a great millstone, Jesus is not messing around. He's talking about a really big millstone. He's saying this is serious business. And I love this. See that you don't despise one of these little ones. For I tell you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. And what happened to the disciples? People were bringing children to the disciples. They haven't put his hands on them and blessed them. Remember, the disciples said, no, don't bother him. And remember, we read Jesus was indignant. He said, no, let the little children come to me. I see them. My Father sees them. We care. We care about these ones that others might neglect. And again, retelling the parable of the lost sheep. Making a great point here. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go in search of the one that went astray? And if he finds it, truly I say to you, he rejoices over it more than one of the 99 that never went astray. So it is not the will of my Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. I see them and I love them. My goal is that they are with me. My heart is that they are with me. So as we get into this, when Jesus is holding this child up and talking to them, there's a difference between a childish faith and a childlike faith. We don't want a childish faith. A childish faith is what the disciples were doing. When they're arguing among themselves about who is the greatest in the kingdom, think about this. What are they basing that on? I am a little more pious than you are, or I've done a few more things than you are, or you do some bad things and I kind of refrain from those things. It's all this very law-oriented, performance-based approach to God. That's a childish faith. God should love me because I'm so good. A childlike faith is very different. A childlike faith says, God, I depend on you to love me. I don't depend on myself to earn anything. I depend on you to love me. And so the way we'd say it is this. The childish faith says, what am I holding on to? What is it about me that I'm holding on to? And the childlike faith says, who's holding on to me? And Jesus is saying, we need to remember who is holding on to us. That's why we have a part in the kingdom of heaven. It's not the things that I'm holding on to that I think make me so great. It's not the things that I'm holding on to that I think make me so terrible either. It's nothing about what we're holding on to. It's about the one who is holding on to us. If we ask some questions about this, there's four questions. I'm going to leave you with these four questions at the end of our time, so pay attention here. What am I holding on to that isn't Jesus? What is it in your life that you hold on to? What is it that you think makes you good, that makes you part of the kingdom of heaven, other than Christ? Because there's really nothing other than Christ that makes us part of the kingdom of heaven. We all have those things we try to convince ourselves of. Here's a positive one. What reminds me that Jesus is holding on to me? When is it that you're most reminded that God is holding on to you? You know, for me, I'm most able to remember that Jesus is holding on to me when I'm struggling, when I'm struggling with my faith, when I'm struggling with sin, when I feel like I'm in the wilderness of life sometimes. It's much easier to remember that it's about Christ who's holding on to me. Interesting. Another couple questions. Who am I overlooking in my own life? Who is it that I haven't been noticing? Who that I haven't been caring about or paying attention to? Who is it that God loves very, very deeply that I'm not spending much time thinking about in my own orbit? And then who are we overlooking at St. Andrew's? This is a big question, right? Who's not here? Who do we need to reach out to? Who needs the love of Christ that isn't here? Who are we overlooking? These are really important questions for us to be asking. I think the kind of questions Jesus was challenging the disciples to ask. You know, we go back to Isaiah 49, and he makes this great point. And I love this. He said, "Can a woman forget her nursing child that she should have no compassion on the son of her womb? Even these may forget, yet I will not forget you. Behold, I have engraved you on the palms of my hand." This is a very powerful verse for a number of reasons. First off, it kind of gives a picture of a love between a mom and her baby. And that is a very powerful bond, as you know. Here's the thing. It could happen that a mom somehow wouldn't care about her baby. That's a very rare thing, but that could happen, right? Here's the deal. He says, even that's an odd thing, that's very rare that would ever happen. God says, I would never do that. I will never forget about you. There'll never be a moment where I don't notice you and care about you. This is how we're loved by God. And in fact, he says, I'm going to engrave you on the palms of my hand. And I sometimes break down in tears when I read this, because in the ancient world, if I belonged to somebody else, if I was someone's slave or servant, they might etch my name on my palm so that whenever I worked, whenever I did anything, I would look down and remember who I belonged to, that I was subservient to somebody, that I was in the possession of somebody. Really remarkable, then what God says is, I've engraved your name on my hands. I've put you on me. In that the master of the universe has engraved us in the palms of his hand, saying, I belong to you. I'll never forget about you. I'll never forget that I have made myself beholden to you in my grace and my mercy. And of course, we know Isaiah is very prophetic. And of course, what he's talking about is what happened many, many years later when Jesus went to the cross. Nails were driven through his palms and through his feet. And when Jesus died and rose again from the dead, I find this very fascinating because he's in a glorified body. And when I think of a glorified body, I think of everything being restored and made new. I want to have a lot of hair when I'm glorified, flowing long mane of hair. Jesus is in a glorified body, but what still remains? Why? Because that's your name written on his palms. You're never forgotten. You're never overlooked. So the question then, as we think about this, as we think about that image of him causing that child to stand, as children who are utterly dependent upon God and holding on to him as he holds on to us first, let's wrestle with what that means for us. And I'm going to give you a couple minutes. You can go back to that pad if you want to write something down. I'm not going to give you a lot of time, so I just need you to wrestle with one of these questions. I'm going to give you about 2 minutes. Wrestle with one of these questions. Prayerfully wrestle with one of these questions. Time is yours.